Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm Graham Richmond, and this is your wiretaps for Monday, January 18th, 2021. I'm joined by Alex Brown from Cornwall, England. Alex, how are things this week?
Very good, thank you, Graham. We're all in lockdown, but we are, everything's good where we are.
Yeah, so this is the 80th episode of Wiretaps that we've done. So yet another milestone for us. And I believe, as you pointed out last time when we were celebrating our 75th episode, that we haven't missed a week. So that's pretty crazy.
We haven't missed a week, and we have verifiable evidence. We have 6 listeners. Isn't that the case?
Yes, in fact, yes, that's a very good point. We got a review over the last week, and I'll just read it to you. The reviewer writes, "Great MBA podcast. Graham and Alex give great perspective on the MBA admissions process. I am a first year at Wharton and can tell you from personal experience that they really helped me out last year with their tips. Also, just a soothing podcast that is easy listening. It should tell you something that even though I'm in business school, I still occasionally find myself listening to episodes. Graham and Alex, keep up the good work. Sincerely, listener number 6." So they obviously were listening. They're listening when we complained about maybe we only have 5 listeners and that's why we're not getting any more reviews. So thank you so much. And I hope that person's having an okay time at Wharton. I know it must be a little challenging with I think they're doing a mix of in-person and at home, or maybe it's all at home now, but hope they're enjoying their time at Wharton. So thanks for that review. Alex, now I did get a call from Blair Mannix, who's the Dean of Admissions at Wharton, saying that the school's faculty does not condone listening to this podcast in lieu of doing classwork. So I got to pass that message along to the reviewer. Fortunately, Alex, for us, Wharton maybe has like bigger problems right now when it comes to dealing with alumni, but in any event, so give me the recap. What's been going on last week and what do we have to look forward to this week?
Yeah, it's been a little bit quiet, as we know, on the sort of MBA admissions landscape in terms of lots of application deadlines over the last couple of weeks. So everybody's been working very hard to get those applications complete. This upcoming week, actually, Sloan has its round 2 application deadline. And then I think maybe there's one more school of the top schools that we cover the following week. But then over the next few weeks, what we'll start to see is those interview invites coming out. And that's where the activity on Livewire and on Clear Admit site really starts to pick up. There are some schools that sort of trickle and roll out interview invites through the season, and we've seen several invites coming out on the wires for Kellogg, for example. But Kellogg tries to interview everybody, so let's make that clear. It's not a good signal if you get an interview waiver at Kellogg, but certainly they try to interview everybody, so they get those interview invites out. A couple of other schools I've seen interview invites trickling out. Tepper, Carnegie Mellon, they're quite notorious for getting in early interview invites out as the round deadline completes. I think we've seen a few from Yale and so forth. But it'll be a couple more weeks before we see the big releases of some of the bigger schools. It's a little bit of the calm before the storm of the invite season, Graham.
Yeah, fair enough. And I want to say that we have those chat rooms on the website that are there for folks who, you know, now that your applications are in, sometimes it can be nice to find other folks who are sitting in the same position as you, waiting, you know, awaiting word. And so we have chat rooms for all the leading schools, and people often hang out in there and talk about whether they've heard or, you know, just general kind of discussion about the whole process. So check that out. The other thing I wanted to mention is that over on clearadmit.com, we did a piece about Berkeley Haas and their expansion of their deferred enrollment offering, which is used to be only open to Berkeley undergraduates and now is open to everyone. So that's a big move for them. That puts them more in line with most of these early access type MBA offerings, you know, HBS 2+2 and Wharton has one. I mean, all the top schools have it. And usually they are open to just anyone who wants to kind of apply to business school as an undergraduate. So that was kind of cool to see. We also did Real Humans on UC Irvine as well as ESA in Spain. And we did a rundown of the McCombs UT Austin employment report. And I forgot to mention this, but we did a special episode of the podcast, or I did, with Shelley Heinrich from Georgetown. And it was all about getting an MBA while raising a family. I don't know if you know this, Alex, but Shelley actually went and got her MBA, an executive MBA, while raising a family. So it was a great conversation about like how one juggles that kind of thing. And I think it's relevant whether you're doing a full-time MBA or, you know, an executive, just how you kind of rely on, you know, family, friends, colleagues, you know, to sort of make it through when you're also having to, you know, raise, in her case, she was, you know, had recently had a baby. And so lots to juggle. Very cool episode. And the last thing I was going to say before we get into the wiretaps portion of the show was we really encourage everyone to share your admissions journey on DecisionWire. So if you already are holding offers, just share it. You can go in and post, indicate where you applied, where you got in, what kind of scholarship dollars you've been offered, and where you're thinking of going, or you can indicate undecided. So we love weighing in on those and seeing them come in. But Alex, is there anything else on your mind this week before we kind of dive into the wiretaps part?
No, I think we should kick off.
All right. So this is wiretaps candidate number one. So this person is applying to start business school in 2022. They've got six schools on the target list, and those schools are Columbia, HBS, MIT, Stanford, Booth, and Wharton. Sort of a who's who of top schools there. This person's pre-MBA career has been as a Navy SEAL and combat medic, so the military candidate. They are hoping to get into consulting after business school, and they've got, you know, Bain, BCG, McKinsey on the list. GMAT score is a 690. GPA 3.7. This person's been working for 9 years, and we'll get into why that's not really 9 years in a moment here, but they're currently in San Diego. They'd love to end up out in the western portion of the United States, and they indicated in their notes that they got a BS in econ from a state university, but they pursued it online while on active duty. So even though they have 9 years of work experience, it sounds like they went in to the military at age 18 when many people went off to college. And so I'm guessing, I just, you know, kind of ballpark figures here, but that means that they're probably, you know, about, I would say 27, if I had to guess. So they're not, it's not like they have 9 years of work experience after a college degree, because they did it concurrently. They did indicate, though, it's weird because in their notes they say they're going to be 32 by the time they start. So maybe they're a bit older than that now. I don't know how the math works here, Alex, but maybe you can help me out.
Yeah, I think you just disproved your simple addition maths right there. If they're 32, then clearly your explanation is wrong.
So how did they do it then? I wonder if they did something else before.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but yeah, fair enough. The guy, I presume male, is a Navy SEAL, Graham. I mean, to me, that just stands out, right? I mean, if you think about a few of the labels of what someone's done, whether it's military, government, whether it's for-profit, non-profit, a few things that completely stand out. Oh, I'm a Navy SEAL. It's like, wow, that is super, super meaningful, right? We kind of, I'm not saying we can have any empathy for what they do, because clearly what they do is spectacular, but absolutely, you know, that in of itself will be a flashing light in the application. But this person seems to have done it a little bit in an unorthodox fashion in terms of their pathway. They didn't go to college and then go into the military post-college, which is more of the typical route. So as they put it, the SEAL Green Beret officer's route into M7. But I know when I was at Wharton, Graham, that at least 1 year we admitted a guy from enlisted. I don't even think they were a Navy SEAL either, by any means, who remains a friend of mine today. So certainly being enlisted coming into the MBA at an M7 is not completely unique, Graham, I would use that term since we clarified that term before we came on air. But yeah, Navy SEAL has to send a very strong message. The fact that they completed their degree concurrently, you know, to me that means, is this person a bit of a bootstrapper along the way? And, you know, they completed that degree concurrently, they got a 3.7. I mean, I know it's from a state school, so maybe there'd be some question over the overall sort of whatever. But the fact is, I think the idea that they're a bit of a bootstrapper too, and a Navy SEAL, and now are on this sort of pathway where they, you know, they want to get the MBA to ultimately go into a long-term role, a COO type role, which is very typical of a military candidate, right? Chief Operating Officer. So a lot of I think a lot of really good stuff. Certainly the Navy SEAL stuff absolutely stands out. The GMAT at 690, well, to me what that says is they're very clever, Graham, because I remember taking the GMAT and the 690 when I took it was very good. Just relative to the averages of the very top schools, it's a little bit below. Is it within their range? It is within their range. But that 690 might be raise a little bit of a question. Also, the fact that they're 32 coming in. So what does that mean? It means that they're really going to need to show their fit for the various programs to which they apply. And what I mean by that is they want to come across as someone who will fully engage in not only the academic elements of the program, but the extracurricular elements of the program, as well as the career management elements of the program. So they want to show that they'll be a real active contributor right across the board. And certainly as a military candidate, reach out to those veterans clubs at each of the schools that you apply and engage and start that now. I think this person's waiting to apply next season, Graham. So that's my initial thoughts.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page overall. I did want to mention that this candidate, we know is a male, actually, because I believe at the moment all Navy SEALs are men. I know that it's open to women, but as of now, there are not yet any women Navy SEALs. So this is a guy. You know, I guess, you know, I wondered if you picked him because, you know, he actually mentioned, I love your podcast. Thanks for all the information you're putting out there and would love to be on it. And I feel like if a Navy SEAL tells me they want something, you know, you kind of just do it, right? So here we are talking about them. But I think you raise all the key issues. It's like they're 32. Is that going to be a problem? I will say, historically, some of the very top programs, and I have in mind HBS and Stanford, they sometimes shy away from candidates who are a little bit older, and there's been some data published online to sort of showcase that. So they tend to go for the younger candidates, but you know, this guy's exceptional in terms of what he's done. I'm not so worried about the online degree aspect of undergrad. I think it's really an interesting story. They got good grades. He got good grades. The GMAT is low. And you know, arguably it's like 40 points below the average at these top target schools on his list. But I'm just hoping that the storyline can overcome, you know, any kind of concerns about whether it's age or academic preparedness, because this guy would be really interesting to have in the classroom for sure. I mean, you were joking with me before we got on the air here, but you know, you were kind of suggesting like, who knows what this guy's done? He's probably been behind enemy lines, you know, air, land, and sea, whatever. You know, it just could be really interesting to have someone like this in the classroom. So, I think they're just going to need to do a really good job in the application materials, and ideally, they've got strong recommendations lined up, and you know, can sort of cross all their T's and dot all their I's so that, you know, any of these concerns fade away. Would you recommend another take on the test or no? I mean, is 690 kind of, do you feel like they're close enough or would you want them to retake if they're not applying till next fall?
Yeah, I mean, if they're not applying till next fall, which is what I gather from the post, then why not have another swing at it if they think there's a chance of improvement? The reality is a 10 or 20 points change on this GMAT will have impact. So just getting over that sort of, I mean, it's not a hard line or anything, but that 700, you get into the 700s, it's a little bit different than when you're in the high 600s, which this person is in. But yeah, absolutely, Graham. I mean, if your GMAT is a little bit dated and it's below the average of the schools that you apply and you've not thought about making the effort to ratchet it up, then maybe you're leaving a little bit on the table in terms of your best effort in the admissions process, right? So that's kind of like one of the golden rules of when you apply to all the top schools, you need to be putting in your best profile and your best efforts. So that might be something for this candidate to explore. Will there be people admitted to Harvard and Stanford with a GMAT of 690 and lower? Absolutely. GMAT is just one of the elements. But if the GMAT is the weakest element of your candidacy, which appears to be the case in this case, then if you can improve the weakest element of your candidacy and you have time to do it, then yeah, that might well be good advice.
Yeah, and you raise a good point. There's this like psychological kind of barrier. I feel like when you see a 690, it looks really different than a 700. Yes, even though, you know, it's like 10 points, but it's not, it's like when you see something that costs $399, you know, your brain works one way and it's, you know, and not it's like, everyone. Yeah. So
$319 on the GRE or $320. I mean, it's a sort of a similar type of psychological effect.
Yeah, exactly. So, in any event, thanks to that candidate for sharing their profile and for listening to the podcast. And obviously, thank you for your service as well. I think, yeah, if they have another, you know, 8 months before they're even working on their applications and applying, I would try to nail the GMAT and get up above 700. That could be really
Let me ask you a question back, Graham. Let's say that this candidate does go back and retake the GMAT. But let's assume that they put a lot of effort into that 690. They put a lot more effort into it and come back with a 680 or a 690. Does that improve this candidate's profile, or is that a potential means of harming the overall profile?
I don't think it harms. I mean, I think they would then want to submit an optional essay that says, look, I worked really hard on the test. I actually took it a second time, landed it at about the same place, but if you look at my, you know, GPA from undergraduate, I think it's more representative of my academic aptitude. So I don't think it's going to hurt them.
Yeah, and the point is, a lot of oftentimes what we look at as admissions officers is the effort that you put in to your candidacy. So the fact that you retook the test is a positive signal. Obviously, if you retake the test and improve the score significantly, that's a very positive signal. But the process of just going through and preparing and retaking the test can reap benefits in the profile. And I'll also say this to folks that are potentially on the wait list now after round one, and you're waffling about whether you should retake the GMAT and so on and so forth. We have seen time and time again folks get admitted off the wait list, not necessarily with a higher test score, but the fact that they made the effort to retake the test. So that effort can be rewarded.
Agreed. Yeah. All right. So let's move on. Thanks for that post again. And let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number two. So this candidate is looking to start business school next fall. So they're in the process of applying right now. They've got three schools on the target list. One of them is Kellogg. They also have UNC and UT Austin. And they've been an architect in their pre-MBA career. And post-MBA, they listed other, but I think they're thinking kind of real estate related stuff. They have a GMAT score of 650, GPA is 3.6. And I guess they've been working for 4 years. They're located in Chicago, and they're happy to go anywhere after business school. They indicate that they've had three promotions in the architecture firm that they work for, and they can show impact outside of architecture at work. They gave some really interesting tidbits about things that they've done at work. And they did apply to UT and UNC in round two, as I guessed here in terms of where they are in the process, and they're actually retaking the GMAT exam and hoping to boost the score and submit it. And they're thinking about, you know, hey, if I get close up to that 700 mark, should I throw in a late round application to Kellogg, or even, you know, begin to think about round one next year or something. So, Alex, what do you make of this candidate? Because they were also wondering, like, how rare is it for an architect to apply to business school?
Is it unique though, Graham?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had an architect in my learning team at Wharton, actually. So it's they exist.
Yeah, they do exist. And we joke just because we were talking about whether something is quite unique, and I don't think anything could be quite unique, right? It's either unique or it's not unique, and so forth. Architects I think can play very well in admissions. They're certainly not overrepresented. That's for absolute certain. And this person does look like they've done very well at work. Three promotions, they can show impact, and that's what we like to see, even outside the specific work of architecture at work. So however they do that, they're also involved in their community, you know, tutoring, reading and writing and stuff. And ADCOM really like that kind of stuff. So you're giving back, you're sharing, and you're doing, stuff that benefits others and so forth. So maybe there's a reason why they've chosen reading and writing programs, and maybe that adds another interesting component. So they've applied to two schools in round two, Texas and Chapel Hill and UNC, Keenan Flagler. And quite frankly, Graham, with their current profile, you know, assuming this work experience is very strong, and the XCs, I mean, obviously the 650 GMAT's going to be the outlier. They've got a 3.6 GPA and so forth. But they may well, hopefully they get to the interview stage. That will be the first signal that will sort of show how well they're doing or whatever. But clearly with these programs, what are they, top 20? I put them in the top 21 bracket in terms of how I have the school structured in my mind. The 650 may well get them in. If they can improve that score, so now they're planning to retake it. Now, if you're retaking the test after the deadline, you can still try to submit it and get it get the ADCOM to use it to make their decisions. You're just running the risk, one, that the ADCOM never actually sees it. You send it in, but it doesn't get in your file or something like that. And secondly, that they've already made a decision. So they might have already decided who to invite for an interview. And if you didn't make the cut, then the GMAT's come in too late. So they run a bit of a risk there. But nevertheless, if they come back with a stronger GMAT score, that can absolutely bolster their opportunities at these two programs. If they come back with this 700 score, is there any validity? So this is a question back to you, Graham. That should they throw the hat into round three at Kellogg? I say absolutely yes. Now, the reality is when you applied in the last round, other than last season, because COVID wreaked havoc on normal application cycles, but typically it's tougher to get in the last round. Schools like Kellogg will have a few spots left, and they're very picky on who takes those spots because they're trying to fill a profile of a class, so they're looking for certain things. Now, if they're looking for real estate folks, then maybe that's a beautiful thing for this candidate. But you're running a big risk applying in round three. But if this person is doing well at work and there's good progression and there's good opportunity to continue to do well at work and have impact and do things over the next several months, if they do have this high GMAT, what they've got to consider is, should I just ditch my opportunities this season for the MBA if it's at Texas or at Keenan Flagler if they do get admitted, and reapply next season with a slightly stronger profile from a work experience standpoint and community experience standpoint and a higher test score? And yeah, if this person had a 700 plus GMAT with all the other stuff in place, then maybe they'd start be talking about Kellogg and Wharton type programs. I mean, that's sort of what you've got to start thinking about, Graham, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I, on the one hand, having had an architect in my learning team at Wharton when I was an MBA student there, I think it was a really interesting kind of perspective. And I think that the thing that admissions teams like about architects, and again, they're not completely uncommon, but they do, there are a handful that will apply each year. The thing that's interesting is that they're sort of right brain, left brain folks, right? So the architecture has a kind of math component, obviously, right? But it also has, there's some creativity, right? So it's a nice voice to have on, in my case, on my learning team at Wharton. And I can't help but think, wow, 3.6 GPA, really successful architecture career, nice outside activities. If this was 750 instead of 650 when it comes to the GMAT score, might we be saying, yeah, M7 or bust, go for it. And so you do raise a really good question, where if they go out there and they take the test again and score exceedingly well, or at least get into the ballpark for these very top programs, you know, maybe they, yeah, stay at work, keep advancing there and apply next fall. With that said, maybe they're, you know, sick of their job and they really want to get up to business school, and both UT and UNC are great MBA programs, and who knows, maybe they'll apply late round to Kellogg. I do think it's always tough applying late. And I will tell you that in informal conversations I've been having with, you know, admissions directors over the course of this season, it's, you know, numbers are good this year in terms of volume. And so I don't think we're going to see what we saw last year, where late round was like a nice way to get into business school. I think it's going to be really challenging as we go through the season this year. So in any event, it's an interesting thing. I don't know what to make of, you know, like part of me wants to tell them, you know what, just wait. But on the other hand, I don't know their personal situation. Maybe they really need to go to business school next fall. There could be any number of reasons for that, right? So it's a tough call. I did want to let you know, Alex, they mentioned that they love the podcast, and they say they listen every week and that they would love to be featured. They said, thanks for all that you guys do. It really helps us unconventional applicants find our way through this difficult process. So it's really nice to hear that. And yeah, and I don't know if we're giving them really clear guidance though. Do you have where do you come down on this? Like, what would you want them to do? Just,
I like that, they're unconventional, not unique, Graham, because clearly you had an architect on your learning team, they can't qualify for the label of unique. But yeah, I think you make a great point. The other thing that I would consider is, if you're going to take a flyer with, let's say, Kellogg in round three, let's say that you do come, this person does come back with a better GMAT score, so develops a bit of a round three strategy, I would maybe look at another program too, because there's a pretty big gap between M7 and Keenan Flagler and McCoobs, which I would put into that 16 to 21 category, or no, 17 to 21 category, I should say. So maybe there's something in that top 16, a school in that top 16 that's pretty good in real estate that might also be worth looking at. So just bear that in mind too. But yeah, I mean, frankly, if they come back with a stellar GMAT, yeah, they probably should be looking at potentially aiming a little bit higher. And if they've got a good work situation, because obviously they're talking about the fact that they might even consider going into the first round next season. So if they're already talking about that, I'm assuming they're in a pretty good spot at work right now.
Okay. Yeah. And again, I think, yeah, that they might want to do some digging on, you know, best schools for real estate, given that that's the direction they're heading in. And they have some really cool ideas about, a you know, setting up a vertically integrated architectural firm with developers. And I mean, so they could.
Yeah, I don't know the best schools. You would know this more. But in my mind, being in LA or New York City is probably a good thing. Those types of cities. And that would, Stern and Anderson would be two schools I'd look at.
Yeah, and there's some others out there. Wharton does really well in this domain. Columbia, obviously New York, right? Cornell has a good real estate program.
I'm
Berkeley.
Sorry,
there's a lot of them.
Yeah, I was just looking at schools between M7 and Keenan Flagler and
okay.
Yeah,
so that makes sense.
That middle spot. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's see how it goes. I wish them the best of luck as they retake the test. And yeah, feel free to keep us posted in the comments on your ApplyWire post. And Alex, I don't know if you did this on purpose, but you've kind of teed up that final Wiretaps candidate for this week, because I believe we're going to talk about a DecisionWire candidate that is also interested in real estate development. So let's move on and talk about Wiretaps candidate number three. So this person they applied to Chicago, Columbia, Harvard, Michigan, Kellogg, and Wharton. And they're going to be starting business school this fall. And they were accepted in round one at Booth, Columbia, Michigan, with a scholarship actually of $150,000, as well as Kellogg with a scholarship of $40,000. And they're currently undecided, and they want to get into real estate. They had a 740 on the GMAT, by the way, I forgot to share that. And they indicate in the notes, they say, look, they say CBS has the best real estate program, but the cultures and learning opportunities of the other schools and 2 years away from New York align more with my interests. Still think I want to work in New York after business school. And so they're saying, would Kellogg or Booth over CBS for real estate be crazy? So Alex, what do you think? Would it be crazy for them to go to Kellogg or Booth? It sounds like they've eliminated Ross from their list, but Would it be crazy for them to do that instead of going to CBS, given that they want to work in real estate?
I don't think it would be crazy. I think it would be easier to go to CBS. I mean, again, CBS is New York City. CBS is a very good real estate program. You're accessed directly into New York City. They want to be in New York City after the MBA. It's all New York City, New York City, New York City. So if you want the easiest route, go to Columbia. But, you know, are taking the other options crazy? No. I mean, if you're looking for a non-New York City option, and that, I mean, again, we've mentioned this time and time again. These are all M7 programs that we're talking about: Kellogg, Columbia, and Booth. So they're all going to provide you great opportunities. It's just if you're at Kellogg and you want to work in New York City in real estate post the MBA, it's going to be a little bit more work to make sure everything happens as you want it to happen, right? So in terms of recruiting and stuff like that. But yeah, these in my mind, these are all at par programs. They're in that same tier. If you just did a ranking on real estate, I'm sure you'd see CBS ahead of Booth and Kellogg. But I wouldn't worry as much about those sort of niche sort of industry related rankings. I'd look at the overall brand of the business school and just make sure that each of the options you're looking at, like Kellogg, like Booth, does have the resources for real estate. As we talked before we came on air, Graham, you looked into Kellogg a little bit and you reckon they've got a pretty good program there.
Yeah, I think, one thing, if this person moves to Chicago to go to Kellogg or Booth, they can connect with the architect that we just talked about who lives in Chicago.
Yeah.
in all seriousness, so what I did is when they mentioned, CBS is the school for real estate, I mean, I know they have a strong real estate program, but that got me thinking, well, let's look into the details of this. And, you know, Kellogg has a real estate track. They have a bunch of courses that you would take to fulfill that track. And we're talking, as you say, these are niche kind of areas. So that we're talking about really small numbers, you know. So only, Columbia being like one of the big real estate schools, only about 4% of the graduating class goes into real estate. So it's a really small amount. At Kellogg, it's more like 2% and change, right? So it's a smaller number. But I don't think it's a small number because everyone in the class wants to do it and only the few are selected. It's just because it's not an area that everyone's going after. And so my view is if this person wants to work in real estate desperately and they go to any of these schools, they can land in real estate. I mean, especially if they, you know, have kind of, some sort of a background that might facilitate that or, you know, can really demonstrate the interest there. I'm not worried about that. I hear what they're saying when it comes to, you know, they want a 2-year break from New York. Sounds like they're in New York now. They're going to be in New York most likely after business school. That's their plan at least. And so they're thinking, a couple years of, you know, getting a break might be nice. And the thing that jumped out at me is that when I think of Kellogg in particular, because I do believe Kellogg has a slightly stronger real estate track than say Booth would have. But when I think of Kellogg, I think of, you know, we've talked about this a few times on recent episodes because it seems like every Decision Wire episode, every Decision Wire candidate has a Kellogg admit that we're debating about. But I feel like Kellogg has, for the time being, a really nice campus and new facilities and a close-knit community that's in an urban center, but just far enough off the beaten path to be a proper campus. Now, Columbia is going to have that very soon because they're opening up that new Manhattanville campus, I believe, if it's not already open. But it's, you know, so those are things to think about too. If this person wants a break and to get somewhere else, I wouldn't call them crazy at all. I mean, also, let's not forget, there's $40,000 on the table from Kellogg. So yeah, these are all, and I would presume the cost of living is going to be lower, in Chicago as well. So anyway, these are things to think about, but I would not call this person crazy for vacillating a bit. So that's my view on it. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on them.
No, and this episode is brought to you, by Kellogg. No, I'm kidding.
No.
I think you make some great points. They could put that $40,000 into an account and say, this is my travel budget to New York and back when I'm recruiting.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know if Columbia has given out their scholarship monies yet. I know the scholarship deadline basically for rolling admissions was beginning of January. So maybe there's still some money coming from Colombia. I just don't know that.
That's possible. Yeah, very possible.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, you've got admissions at three fantastic M7 programs. You've also got a full ride at Ross. I mean, fantastic opportunities. There's no one right answer here, absolutely.
Yeah, and you make a good point. So depending on the person's personal situation, like there could be someone who goes to Ross in this scenario, who, you know, there could be somebody who goes to Calc. So it really depends. But hopefully they can weigh all these different factors. But I will say it's 2 years of your life and you want to be somewhere where you're going to be happy and where you have fit. Because we talk about this all the time, but these particular programs, when we talk about Kellogg and Booth and even MIT, Columbia, they're so closely matched that you just got to go where you feel like you have the best opportunities and where you're going to fit in. So good luck making that choice. Alex, we've done it again. We've somehow managed to spend 30 minutes talking about MBA applications and applicants. So thanks for picking these out as always. And we'll be back in a week's time, I guess. Anything else you wanted to share this week?
No, very good. Thank you, Graham. Stay safe, everybody. Best of luck. And we'll be back in a week.